Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
We're anticipating that there will be members who will be without power through Thursday of this week, and we recognize that that is a long time for an outage.
Hundreds of households in the interior are still without power after Monday's windstorm. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, July 27th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, homeless families move from an Anchorage campground to shelters, including one with a newborn.
When we found out, of course, there was an actual baby here too, we immediately got them out of here.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Are you ready to start accelerating your child's future through education? The Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program is expanding its reach with new opportunities in Juneau and Southeast Alaska. With ANSEP's Acceleration Academy, high school students can earn college credit, save thousands of dollars in college costs, and experience fun, hands-on learning. ANSEP, it's a better way to learn. Learn more and enroll at ansep.net/acceleration. This message sponsored by ANSEP.
A quick warning here. This first story is about a violent incident involving children. 4 children are dead in what Alaska State Troopers say was a murder-suicide in Fairbanks. A trooper statement says officers responded to a call about shots being fired yesterday afternoon at a home in the Sky Ridge Drive subdivision. Troopers say they found 4 children dead from gunshot wounds and 3 other youth at the residence uninjured. The parents were not home. Troopers say investigation determined that one of the dead children, a 15-year-old boy, shot the 3 siblings and then himself. The Office of Children's Services has been notified and the bodies of the 4 dead youth are being sent to the state medical examiner's office. Also, anyone struggling with thoughts of suicide can now call a simple 3-digit number, that's 988, to reach the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline. Again, that's 988. The Salvation Army reports that 34 people staying at the Centennial Campground in Anchorage have moved into shelters or permanent housing. The Salvation Army took over on-site client care last Tuesday and prioritized moving families into more permanent shelter. As of Friday, there were no more children at the camp, according to the Salvation Army. Salvation Army Captain Denise Delgado says the youngest child at the camp last week was 2 days old.
When we found out, of course, there was an actual baby here too, we immediately got them out of here.
2 people reconnected with family members and are returning home, 1 to St. Paul Island and 1 to Texas. 10 people are set to join a workforce development program conducted by Beans Cafe. Delgado says not all of the campers are interested in moving into shelters or permanent housing. She says mental health challenges and alcohol or drug dependence are often barriers.
Some people just want to be left alone. Some people, honest to goodness, want to be here. They don't want to cooperate. And a lot of that has to do with mental health. That's huge. And then you got individuals who are inebriated or have an addiction, and you can't force them into treatment. They got to choose it for their own.
On Friday, Salvation Army volunteers counted 110 people at the campground. Sunday's count brought the tally to 143. Delgado says the number of people staying at the camp is constantly changing. The city opened up the campground to homeless people a month ago after the closure of the Sullivan Arena shelter led many to camp outside. Last night, the Anchorage Assembly voted down a measure that would have allowed the city parks director to extend the legal camping limit past 14 days. It's too soon to say whether that will significantly impact the number of people who choose to stay at Centennial Campground, but Delgado says the Salvation Army will be there as long as they're needed.
We'll still be here. We're not under contract. We have no obligation to be here, but we stepped in because there was a need, and we'll continue to do that as long as possible.
The Salvation Army is asking the public for donations, especially men's clothing. They've also asked for men's and women's sweatshirts and sweatpants, bus passes, and gas vouchers. And the Anchorage Assembly voted Tuesday night to put millions of dollars toward housing for Anchorage's homeless population. The vote came after the Assembly rejected Mayor Dave Bronson's proposal that would have allowed for the waiving of camping limits at the controversial Centennial Campground. Alaska Public Media's Wesley Early reports.
At the end of June, Mayor Bronson's administration closed the Sullivan Arena mass shelter that was put up in response to the COVID-19 pandemic. Around that time, the mayor also waived camping fees at the city-owned Centennial Campground in Northeast Anchorage and directed homeless campers to the area, in some cases busing people from the Sullivan to the campground. Now, a month later, it's unclear how long the controversial plan to use Centennial as a makeshift homeless camp will continue. Bronson has repeatedly denied that using the campground is part of the city's official response for homelessness, but on Tuesday, his team asked the assembly to consider waiving parking limits at the campground, which would allow people to stay longer than 14 days. He argues the campground is a safer option than people illegally camping in the woods.
Well, we are working every angle to place people in shelter, treatment, services, and permanent housing. We will still continue to make sure that at Centennial, there is access to water, showers, restrooms, and Wi-Fi, as well as additional resources across the campground.
Already, the 14-day limit has not been enforced at the Centennial Campground, with many people staying more than 14 days over the past month. Meanwhile, the campground has been a source of controversy, with concerns raised over the camp's proximity to bears, a lack of available resources for homeless campers, and a lack of communication with assembly leaders and community councils. At least 5 bears have been shot at the campground after rifling through tents, a woman died from a drug overdose, and a shootout between police and a felony suspect resulted in the suspect and an officer being hospitalized. East Anchorage Assemblymember Forrest Dunbar said approving Bronson's request about camping limits would be an endorsement of the mayor's efforts in creating a large homeless presence at the campground.
What we've seen is this chaotic process that ended with this tragedy, this humanitarian crisis that's happening now in Centennial Park. It is a complete failure of leadership by this mayor and this mayor alone, acting unilaterally.
Dunbar and 8 other members voted against the measure, with members Jamie Allard, Randy Salt, and Kevin Cross supporting the ordinance. The city has not yet said when it will stop waiving camp fees at Centennial. It estimates just over 140 people are using the campground. While the assembly rejected the mayor's camping proposal Tuesday, a majority of members did approve 2 ordinances that are part of the multi-tiered anchored home plan brought forward by assembly members Felix Rivera, Cameron Perez-Verdia, and Daniel Volin to address what they call a, quote, humanitarian housing crisis in Anchorage. The first ordinance gives $500,000 to United Way to renovate up to 60 housing units, with another roughly $1.2 million going to the Anchorage Health Department to fund cold weather renovations for emergency shelters. The ordinance also gives roughly $1.7 million to the Anchorage Coalition and Homelessness for outreach and transportation costs. Most of the more than $4 million comes from alcohol taxes that have already been appropriated for sheltering costs, with the rest also coming from the alcohol tax fund. Assemblymember Cross of Eagle River said using alcohol taxes to, quote, reinvest in problems created by alcohol was a good move, speaking favorably of the funds for the United Ways project.
What we see here is for individuals that are putting forth a good faith effort to improve their situation and turn themselves around, and therefore they qualify for these funds.
The assembly approved the funding measure 9-2, with members Allard and Salt voting against it. The second ordinance approved by the assembly gives a grant of up to $3.4 million to First Presbyterian Anchorage so the group can purchase the guest house building downtown. Ideally, the building would add 110 workforce housing units and another 20 permanent supporting housing units. That funding comes from the American Rescue Plan Act. Reverend Matt Schultz of First Presbyterian said the building won't be a shelter and instead will be housing for people struggling to find affordable rentals in Anchorage.
We will be helping to provide dignified, stable housing for people who are workforce ready.
The measure was passed by an 8-3 vote, with Cross, Allard, and Salt opposed. In total, the funding from the 2 ordinances passed by the assembly came to roughly $7.6 million. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Wesley Early.
Repair crews have made significant progress fixing power lines hit by trees in a windstorm in interior Alaska on Monday. Golden Valley Electric Association says line crews have restored service to all but about 2,000 of the 30,000 affected members. GVEA spokeswoman Meadow Bailey says the initial focus was in the urbanized areas of Fairbanks.
So really, we're reminding anybody who is in a more remote location or is who is part of a smaller outage to make sure that you're prepared. We're anticipating that there will be members who will be without power through Thursday of this week, and we recognize that that is a long time for an outage.
The last extended weather-related GVEA power outage was caused by unusual heavy snow and rain last Christmas. Bailey says this week's similarly rare summertime wind-caused outage is even worse in terms of impacts to electric infrastructure.
Our crews are reporting back that the damage they're seeing is more severe than even what we experienced during the December storms. We're seeing more broken and pulled down lines than we did in December.
Bailey says most of the trees that fell onto lines were growing outside of the right-of-way, which the utility keeps clear. She cautions people about the danger posed by trees on power lines and says so far GVEA is not aware of anyone being hurt.
We do have concern, though, and have heard about quite a few close calls. And so we remind people, don't try to remove trees from a line on your own. And I say that knowing that there are people who have been 36 or 48 hours without power and getting frustrated.
Bailey asks that customers call GVEA's dispatch line to report outages or trees on power lines, and then be patient until a crew can get there. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the first signs of an invasive crab species appear in southeast Alaska.
I think it's a wake-up call that they are moving our way. They are, you know, detected here now.
Green crabs coming up. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Invasive plants and animals threaten Alaska's waters and can spread to new locations by hitching a ride. Anyone can help stop aquatic hitchhikers by remembering to clean boots, boats, and trailer to remove plants, animals, and mud. Drain bilge, ballast, and buckets before leaving the area, and dry equipment before using it in a new body of water. Learn more at stopaquatichitchhikers.org. This message sponsored by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
Republican congressional candidate Tara Sweeney says she's focused on her campaign for a full 2-year term in the U.S. House. She's no longer on the special election ballot to decide who serves the remainder of the late Congressman Don Young's term, but she says she's not discouraging anyone from writing in her name.
Folks are, you know, going to be voting the way that they vote, and if they write in my name, that is really kind of the prerogative of the individual voter.
The Division of Elections says write-ins won't count unless they're for a candidate who has registered as a write-in, and Sweeney hasn't, but she has until August 11th.
I don't think, you know, we've ruled out any options. This election has been absolutely full of twists and turns and surprises, and so, you know, it'd be crazy to rule out any sort of options.
Sweeney is one of the best-funded candidates. Her campaign has raised about $280,000. A separate independent group working to get her elected has raised more than double that amount. Sweeney finished fifth in the special primary in June, so not high enough to advance to the special general election on August 16th. But that's also the day of the Pick One primary in the regular election for the full term that starts in January. Sweeney is among 22 candidates in that race. Four will advance to the November ballot. The three U.S. House nominees on the special election ballot are Republicans Nick Begich III and Sarah Palin, and Democrat Mary Peltola. They are also running for the full term. A major housing project planned for Girdwood has upset some residents of that hamlet at the southern edge of the municipality of Anchorage. That's not because Girdwood doesn't need more housing. Most there agree that it does. But the city's plan to develop 60 acres near Glacier Creek into more than 100 homes does not include any units cheaper than $500,000. And Girdwood, home to Alyeska Resort and many businesses catering to visitors, is most acutely feeling the pinch for more affordable housing. Anchorage Daily News reporter Alex DeMarbon wrote about the Holton Hills project recently. DeMarbon says for tiny Girdwood, it would be a huge development.
Just looking at the map, you can see that it would be at least kind of one-fifth of what Girdwood is. If it were in Anchorage, it would be the equivalent of 20,000 housing units. And so in the small town of Girdwood with 2,000 people, it's going to have a huge impact. Some of the homes luxury, some of the units fairly small, and the city would initially do some of the work to prepare the extension of the utilities, but the developer would get the utilities to the lots. So that would be an expensive process to get the land ready for sale. And then the developer, CY Investments, owned by Connie Yoshimura, would then sell the land to home builders, and the profits from the sales would be divided between the city and Connie's company.
And that's kind of for people that might just be driving through Girdwood, that's kind of behind the mercantile and near the elementary school?
Yeah, off the elementary school, the post office area where a lot of people don't go, yeah, who visit because they're typically going straight to the resort.
Yeah. So the folks in Girdwood ostensibly would get more housing, but there are no guarantees that the type of housing that Girdwood actually says it needs would be included in this project, right? And that's created a little bit of
concern. So Girdwood's main requirement and what it wants most of all for this project is that there be affordable housing, housing that workers can afford. And we're not just talking about the maybe lower income restaurant worker, but even teachers and firefighters, professionals in town are having difficulty finding places to stay. But the smallest unit at this point is estimated to cost $500,000 by the time it's ready for someone to rent. And so clearly that's not affordable to a lot of salaries anywhere. Yeah, they're disappointed they're not able to have any guarantees for workforce housing. The project developers have also said that affordable housing home builders could buy some of the land, develop some of the houses, and so that it would be one way to create affordable or workforce housing.
Yeah, and I guess they also said that this project would open up more housing in Girdwood for people that already live there that might leave their homes and somebody else could purchase those, I guess. But like you said, there's no guarantees that any of that might happen at this point. And it sounds like that's what some Girdwood residents want. These halt Holton Hills signs have popped up, right? Mm-hmm. What did some of the folks, some of the business owners and other folks in Girdwood that you talked to tell you about all that?
In general, my understanding is that most people in town are opposed to the project as it exists now. There's definitely a wide array of views on the project, and some people don't want it at all. They're ready for it to be stopped completely. But there's definitely a lot of people who are hoping that there can be some sort of resolution to have workforce housing in the project. There's definitely a lot of passion about the project. You have those Holton Hills signs. Business owners are very concerned about not being able to have workers, and so they want to make sure that there's affordable housing of some sort that's created in there. Like the owner of the subway there, for example, who wasn't quoted in the story, but he can't get workers there who are from Girdwood anymore like he used to 10 years ago or so when he started. They all have to be imported from Anchorage.
But if you're working in the service industry, maybe in a resort town where that's the primary industry, and you just need a place to stay, you don't want to have to drive from Anchorage.
No, you definitely don't want to
drive. Gas prices the way they are, right? Well, if the Girdwood residents are upset about this, how much power do they even have through the local boards there or what? The Girdwood Board of Supervisors doesn't get to say yes or no on this, right?
They can basically make recommendations as they're doing. A lot of the community members wanted them to make a stronger recommendation, as in, you know, we want you, Heritage Land Bank, to kill this project if there can't be worker housing. So the ask from the Girdwood Board of Supervisors, the local governing body, is not quite so direct, but it's still calling for an effort to find a way to get worker housing into the project.
Gotcha.
So,
and then I guess also the Anchorage Assembly has to approve it ultimately, right?
Yes, and that's going to be a huge area of impact where the community can make a difference. I mean, the assembly members are definitely watching the process and listening. And some people could imagine that if Girdwood is not happy with this huge development, that the assembly is not going to fully support the project.
That was Anchorage Daily News reporter Alex DeMarbon. You can read his full story about the Holton Hills project planned for Girdwood at ADN.com.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
First National Bank, Alaska, celebrating 100 years of helping Alaskans shape a brighter tomorrow. Learn more at fnbalaska.com.
Are you ready to start accelerating your child's future through education? The Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program is expanding its reach with new opportunities in Juneau and Southeast Alaska. With ANSEP's Acceleration Academy, high school students can earn college credit, save thousands of dollars in college costs, and experience fun, hands-on learning. ANSEP, it's a better way to learn. Learn more and enroll at ansep.net/acceleration. This message sponsored by ANSEP.
Sailings on the MV Tustamina have been canceled until Saturday, July 30th, due to a crew shortage, according to the Alaska Department of Transportation. The Tustamina is the only Alaska Marine Highway System ferry that sails between all 13 ports of call out the Aleutian chain. The Tusty hasn't been so trusty lately. It went into the shipyard for extensive repairs back in December and only returned to service earlier this month. It docked in Homer yesterday, according to the DOT, where it remains in port. The department said in its release that insufficient staffing has been an issue throughout the ferry system despite $5,000 signing bonuses to attract new crew members. It will be updating the ship's service schedule in a press release and on social media in the coming days. Well, there will be no poultry at the Tanana Valley State Fair in Fairbanks this year. Fair Board President Colleen Turner says the decision was made because of the threat of avian influenza.
We really felt that it was in the best interest of people who bring their poultry to the fair that we make sure that they're safe and that we don't cause any undue harm to those animals. And so that's why we made that decision, and it was thoroughly vetted with our livestock committee and the state vet and our board of directors.
Turner says the decision also took into account the fairgrounds location next to the Creamers Field Migratory Waterfowl Refuge.
They've actually had birds there infected. That made it a higher risk, and so we really felt like we could not have the poultry here because of that.
The Tanana Valley State Fair starts Friday. Turner says preparations are going well, despite Monday's windstorm, which damaged some vendor tents. Turner says the fair's big top tent barely survived the high winds.
Quite a few people's tents were blown away and destroyed, but I have to tell you, people are very resilient, helping to find poles to put things together.
The Tanana Valley State Fair runs from July 29th through August 7th. An invasive species with the potential to wreak havoc on important commercial and subsistence fisheries has been found in Alaska for the first time. As KRBD's Eric Stone reports, biologists with Metlakatla Indian Community say they found the first evidence of European green crabs on Annette Island near the southern tip of southeast Alaska.
Scientists had been looking for the crabs for years, and to their relief, so far they had come up empty. Then came a troubling find on the beaches of Annette Island, three shells from a European green crab.
Well, everybody was pretty much shocked, I guess is the best word.
Dustin Winter, the director of Metlakatla Indian Community's Fish and Wildlife Department, says the mid-July find is the first evidence of the invasive species' presence in Alaska. The tribe has been working with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration to monitor the season's shores for signs of the crab. The crustaceans are 2 to 4 inches wide with spines on their head. Metlakatla biologists started setting traps in 2020 after a shell fragment was found in Haida Gwaii. That's an island chain off the coast of northern British Columbia.
Started out kind of small, but it's turned into quite the project now. We have three, sometimes four people working every other week, setting pots and pulling pots and recording what kind of crabs they're catching.
Winter says that as of July 22nd, they still haven't located a live specimen, but NOAA fisheries biologist Linda Shaw says the discovery means it's time to take action.
I think that it definitely is a reason for concern, but not any kind of panic. I think that it's a wake-up call that they are moving our way. They are, you know, detected here now, so we need to take it seriously, but we are not in the situation yet that Washington State is.
In Washington, Governor Jay Inslee declared an emergency over the state's green crab infestation in January. The state has spent millions fighting the spread of the species. Last year, the Lummi Nation near Bellingham reported capturing 70,000 during a five-month span.
In the past year, their populations have exploded in Washington State and Oregon.
Scientists say the crustaceans are a threat to ecosystems and commercial fisheries. They uproot eelgrass beds in search of food, which serve as habitat for herring and salmon. Shaw says they're also a threat to fellow shellfish.
They compete with juvenile Dungeness crab. They are shellfish predators, so things like clams they would directly eat. And then there's also anecdotal information from British Columbia that they predate on juvenile salmon.
Invasive European green crabs have been found in U.S. waters since the 19th century. Scientists say their microscopic larvae likely hitched a ride in the ballast tanks of ships crossing the Atlantic, and they've hurt native species. The crabs are blamed for the decline of the soft-shell clam fishery in Maine. They were first found on the West Coast in 1989 in San Francisco Bay and have been spreading north and south ever since. Shaw says the crabs tend to spread with El Nino. That's the weather pattern characterized by higher than normal sea surface temperatures in the central and eastern Pacific. She says warming ocean temperatures associated with climate change also play a role.
Warmer temperatures would allow greater survival and reproductive time frames, right? So if it's warmer, they have more chance to reproduce and they have better growth and they have a longer season.
So what can be done to prevent them from spreading further north? Shaw says for now, trapping the crabs is thought to be the most effective approach.
So, you know, enclosed bays and areas are places where we might be able to do intensive trapping to, if not eradicate, at least control them, especially in areas where you have resources at risk that are important.
It's also important to know where the crabs are, so scientists are asking the public to keep an eye out for them. Though they're called green crabs, they're found in a variety of colors. Shaw says they're most identifiable by the spines on either side of their eyes.
We like to say find the five spines. So green crab have five spines on either side, right and left of their eyes, and then three bumps in the middle. And those are the only crabs in Alaska right now with those characteristics.
Officials are asking people who find green crabs in Metlakatla to bring them to the Department of Fish and Wildlife Office. Sightings can also be reported in Metlakatla and elsewhere to the Alaska Invasive Species Hotline. That's 1-877-INVASIVE. With additional reporting from KRBD's Reagan Miller, reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Eric Stone.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Wesley Early in Anchorage, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Dylan Samard in Kodiak, and Eric Stone in Ketchikan. Our audio engineer is Tobin Shelby. Katie Anastas is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil exploration and production and working to create economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources.
Planning today for a gift down the road builds a legacy of support for the media you treasure. Thank you for considering this public radio station in your estate planning. You can talk to your financial advisor or contact your public radio station to learn more. Thank you. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.